You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lillian Hanley tōku ingoa, nō mā haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 30th of January. My name is Lillian Hanley. I'm joined in studio by Marcus Jones from AUT. How's it going, Marcus?
Pretty good, thanks.
Hot?
A little.
It's like one of the few times that I'm not complaining that it's too cold in the studio. This is great. Those of you listening would know that I did The Wire yesterday, so I'm sorry that I've got to put up with my voice again today, but it's all good. Got a big show on Dear Science. We are talking about ancient Earth rocks found on the moon, the rise in fetal genetic testing, and the probable end of the Opportunity rover on Mars, which I'm intrigued about. Also the fetal genetic testing. Marama Davidson talks to Hamish Webber about international spying, and we hear a long form piece on a film made by artist Shakaya Perez for a Royal Academy of Arts exhibition in London, and this discussion goes into issues of representation, activism, art and decolonisation. Remember, you can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 Waiamairane or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Let's get into it.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Classic. Classic intro. We are going to be changing this intro soon.
Oh no. What are you going to put it at?
Keep tuned. We've got a little sponsor, but it doesn't start yet. So
yes, so I heard about this.
We'll talk about it soon, but stay tuned. Okay, first up, ancient Earth rocks.
Okay.
Earth rocks found on the moon?
Earth rocks.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a surprising place to find bits of Earth. Yeah, but so it's one of the oldest rocks, or oldest known rocks, has actually turned up on the moon. And how do we know? Well, the astronauts obviously went up there in the late 60s, early 70s and brought back, I think, many kilograms of moon rocks, hundreds of kilograms, I think, of moon rocks in total. And most of them have been sitting in various cupboards and things around, mainly in the US, for decades now. And they've been studied to an extent, but as analytical instrumentation gets better and better and better, and the experiments we can do get more and more precise and accurate, we can actually determine a lot more about what's going on in these rocks
that
were brought back from the moon. So what they found is a 2-centimeter chip, a little piece of rock, embedded within a larger rock that's been dated to about 4 billion years. So it's pretty old. Yeah. It's been determined that this little chip of rock is actually originated on Earth, not on the moon.
What?
Yeah. And so this isn't that unusual, because we've actually found rocks from Mars on Earth. We've figured out. And so these things are usually caused by asteroid collisions. So yeah. Sometime around 4 billion years ago, a big chunk of rock hit the Earth and blasted a lot of material out into space. And some of that, obviously, landed on the moon.
Yeah? Okay.
And because the moon doesn't have an atmosphere, it doesn't really have weather or things that erode rocks, it just sat there.
For a long time.
4 billion or plus whatever years, yeah? And at the time, the moon was actually 3 times closer to the Earth than it is today. So the moon is actually slowly receding by, you know, millimeters a year or something like that. But, 4 billion years ago, it was
much closer.
Much closer, so therefore much bigger in the sky.
Is that a problem, that it's going further away?
No.
Okay.
Well, certainly not in our lifetimes or in the next, you know, billion years worth of lifetime. So I don't think we need to worry about that.
Probably won't be here then.
Yeah, so how did they do it? So they looked at trace elements in the rock. They looked at It's a mixture of quartz and feldspar and zircons. And these zircons have actually been found in Australia. And some of the oldest known rocks are these contain this mineral called zircon, which has been dated to 4 billion plus 4.5 billion years. So they're the actual oldest that we know of. But this is still pretty old. They actually look at uranium, traces of uranium, which is radioactive, and they look at the decay of that uranium. They look at titanium levels, which tells you the temperature and the pressure when the rock was formed. And they other trace elements like cerium looks at the amount of water that was likely to have been present. And so they figured out that the rock probably formed in a water-rich environment with temperatures and pressures corresponding to about 19 kilometers beneath the Earth's surface. So whatever this big asteroid was, it slammed in so hard.
Really deep.
And just ejected a ton of material.
How did that... I mean, so we're talking major force here coming down into the Earth so that it exploded enough to get out of our atmosphere.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want to have been standing there. But then again, nothing really was at the time.
Right.
This was pre-life, I think.
Okay.
So it's been sitting there for 4 billion years, and it's interesting that only there's 382. I've got the number now. 382 kilograms of rock was brought back, which is quite a hefty chunk of rock. Yeah, but only a small fraction of it has actually been studied. And as techniques get better, you know, they expect to find more bits
little
of Earth
clues and
you know,
things
from that big haul.
I'm intrigued as to how you actually study rock. Do they have some break it up and do bits and pieces on
not a geologist,
different
but
tests?
Yeah, I guess break it up and study it with different wavelengths of light. You fire electrons at it. You look at you can determine what materials are, what elements are in the rock. You can determine how they're structured, where they're sitting. You can identify different minerals, how they're all sort of situated relative to each other.
Wow.
It's that's geology.
Studying rocks.
Mm,
okay.
Exciting.
The rise in fetal genetic testing.
Yeah, so... just gathering my thoughts for a moment there.
Testing.
Yeah, so parents or expectant parents, you know, obviously want to know whether the baby is going to be healthy, mm-hmm. whether there are any problems. And there's, you know... as a recent parent, you know, I wanted to know as much as possible about whether my kids were going to be healthy. When
you yourself were a
yes.
recent parent?
Yes, I am.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. and so there's a lot of information that can be get. And historically, what doctors have done is a test called amniocentesis, where a little needle is put into the fetus and a bit of material is pulled out. And you can look at that material, but there's risks associated with that.
In terms of damaging the fetus,
yeah, it's rare, but it happens, I think, yeah. And so, more recently, scientists have come up with tests where they actually look for little fragments of DNA from the fetal DNA that is in the mother's bloodstream.
Right. Okay.
Right, and they can identify that rather than doing some sort of invasive test on the fetus. And so there's all sorts of tests that can screen for dozens of spontaneous arising genetic disorders. Lots of examples, but Down syndrome is one, and there's many, many more. Okay. And so they wanted to sort of try and work out how reliable these tests are and how useful they will be. Mm. So there was a recent study where they tested 422 samples from 131 clinics around the world. And some of the samples came from pregnancies with abnormal ultrasound findings. So you look first with ultrasound. If you see something, then you might
you
go in further.
Further,
yeah, but you don't have to. You can do tests just as a matter of course. And others had no indication of trouble. So 32 of that 422 tested positive for some sort of genetic disorder. Yeah.
32
out
okay.
of 422.
Okay.
Yeah. And the team were able to follow up on the outcomes from 233 of the pregnancies and found that of the testing, there were no false positives and no false negatives. In other words,
it was all accurate.
They got it right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's a long test, though. When did they follow up with the kids?
This was over the last couple of years, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Now, the tests will have to be repeated on a grander scale to nail down what risks they are and things like that, and establish who would benefit most from this technology, because it will add expense to caring for a pregnant mother, but it seems inevitable that parents want as much information as possible.
Right. So this test is being done to find out what the risks are, even though these tests are already happening, right? Parents are already engaging in these tests. Or are they trying to figure out what better ways of testing for...
So in some countries, these tests are already being used. In the States, for instance, this is relatively common. In other countries, not so much yet, but I think it's going to move that way. And obviously, they will tell you with a very high degree of certainty, if they come up with a positive, that your child will have X, Y, or Z genetic disorder. Here are the consequences. And at that point, you're faced with a set
decision.
Of choices. Yeah, exactly.
Because, do you want to go into the ethics of this?
We can.
Yeah?
Yeah. So, a lot of parents will welcome this. And definitely, speaking as a parent now, I wanted as much information as possible. And I think that's pretty going to be pretty likely for just about any parent. But obviously, the big decision is, what do you do with that information? Mm. And obviously, if it's everything's negative, then you're all happy and everything. But if it's positive, then there has to be a much sort of an expansion of the amount of counseling about this genetic information that parents get. Mm. And so that's going to add into
the costs.
Yeah. So if the tests are going to come in and be expanded across New Zealand and other countries, then the associated counselling, genetic counsellors and things like that will have to be made available too. And there is a shortage. There is a shortage of genetic counsellors, and there also needs to be efforts to educate physicians and the patients themselves on what's available and what they can actually do with these results.
This isn't compulsory, though, is it? Because I know that, like you said, there are a lot of parents that would welcome this, but there are a lot of parents who might just decide not to.
This isn't compulsory. It's an elective test. We had two children in the US, and we elected to have these tests done. And in the end, we were glad we did, but it added expense to the whole process. Yeah.
Okay. Last one, the probable end of the Opportunity rover on Mars.
So this
they're just going to stop?
Well, this is a bit sad, actually. I don't know if you remember, but about 15 years ago, in fact, 15 years ago this month, the two rovers landed on Mars.
I probably don't remember, that because I might have been like 9 years old. But
okay. I don't see why you wouldn't have remembered, but okay.
I might have been doing other things, sorry.
All right, so 15 years ago, yes, these two rovers landed on Mars. One was called Spirit and one was called Opportunity. And they landed on different parts of the planet, and they rolled out of their little capsules and started exploring. And they were really there had been one earlier mission, which was a much smaller rover that went about 2 meters and died. But these were expected to go for 90 days. That was the length of the mission. They went considerably further than that, or they went for considerably longer than that. So the two rovers, Spirit lasted until, I think, 2013. So that was...
When you say last,
roving around Mars. This 90-day sort of rover was roving around for, nearly 10 years. And sending back data and sending back pictures, and eventually the solar cells died and the batteries failed and just died. Opportunity kept going. So Opportunity.
Is that rover still there? Is it?
It's sitting on Mars.
We've littered on Mars.
We have littered Mars. Mm. Yes. Yes, we have. Well, maybe we'll go there in the future and pick them up.
Okay.
Because they'll be sitting there. So in June of last year, there was a big dust storm that basically encircled the planet, blotted out the sun, which makes it hard for these things to operate because they rely on solar power. And so Opportunity went into a sort of a hibernation mode, but it never came out.
Right.
Yeah, and they've sent lots of commands to the rover, you know, over the radio signals, to commands to try and retrieve it or revive it. But they haven't worked, and they were hoping that some seasonal winds that run between sort of November and the end of January would sort of blow away the dust from the solar panels, but they didn't, or at least it hasn't revived it. So this is sort of incredible, though, because it's a remarkable mission. 15 years into a 90-day mission, and it's taken out. It's only been taken about by one of the worst dust storms ever recorded on Mars. So they were pretty hardy. Spirit lasted, until 2011. And because now it's going into the Martian winter, where opportunity is, the temperatures are getting lower, the chances of actually reviving it are pretty much dead.
Okay, yeah. So this is why you're saying probable, that they are going to try?
They're still trying. They think that it's getting less and less likely.
So does that mean like a proper formal end to that mission?
That mission will then end, yes. Mm. I mean, there are now other rovers on Mars. Yeah. And since that. But these were the first two sort of big ones. And it's sort of, you know, they've been plugging away by themselves for many years, much, much longer than they thought. And there's the scientists who... You know, when they signed up for these missions, these Spirit and Opportunity missions, and few of them realized that they'd still be working on it 15 years later, which is sort of incredible. And they've done tons. They've done tons of work. They've Opportunity was supposed to last 90 days. It ended up lasting nearly 5,000 days. Mm. It traversed a path 45 kilometers long, so that's quite a distance. Often driving backwards because its steering control overheated. So it just went backwards instead,
okay.
As you do. It went to explore lots of craters. Its camera was still working perfectly. It revealed a lot of amazing science. So they think they found evidence of water in prehistory on Mars, they revealed that the periods of habitability, in other words, Earth-like conditions on Mars, extended far longer into the Martian past than they previously thought. Mm-hmm. And it spotted veins of different minerals caused by evaporating water and things like that. So it was a big success, but it's sad that it's finally
coming to an end.
Wow. Yeah.
Do you feel sad?
Well, I remember when these things rolled out 15 years ago, because I'm a couple of years older than you. I remember watching it and seeing the first pictures they sent back. And so, yeah, it is a bit sad.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to end on that note, but we'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Okay.
With more new science.
That was Dear Science.
That was indeed Dear Science, and we'll be back after the song Master and Slave by W.Y. Huang.
Māori grievances about land are historical. We didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, you know, started demanding our things back.
The Wire. Shakaya Perez, also known as Travelling Feather, is of Afro-Polynesian descent and is a multidimensional artist, blogger and DJ, working on visual performance and activism art. Shakaya has been overseas and recently returned home to Aotearoa. While she was in London late last year during the anniversary celebrations of Captain Cook, she was commissioned by the Royal Academy of Arts for an exhibition called Cosmic Ocean, along with other Pacifica artists that celebrated contemporary oceanic culture and the unique natural landscape of the Pacific Islands from seas to skies, says the website. Shakaya chose to make a film which was called Exotic Savage, The Decolonization, and the blurb read as follows. This new multisensory artwork incorporates poetry, dance, film, installation and participatory performance art to weave together narratives of decolonialism while celebrating Perez's layered heritage and the stories of those in her communities. I spoke with Shakaya about the exhibition, but first started by getting her to tell me more about her background and upbringing, given this is the very experience which informs her work. I want to talk about this exhibition and the film that you've made, but I want to start because a lot of what you do is informed by who you are, which is really, really important, I think, in the film. And you have told us bits and pieces here. Can you maybe explain a bit about your journey to becoming who you are in terms of the artwork that you do, the visual performance stuff, but also then how you kind of came to be in London?
Right, so I started off as a young child. I was always quite creative and I was always interested by dance. So when we moved from Whanganui to Auckland when I was about 4 years old, I was kind of encapsulated in this whole idea of creativity, movement and performing arts. And then I started off actually in mainstream schooling, and then when I was about 7 years old, I asked my mother if I could go and learn Te Reo Māori. So she enrolled me at a Māori school, and then I did that from primary all the way into high school. And for me, having my culture is like, you know, having my culture there every single day was something that was became normal to me and something that I actually needed. And for me as a dancer growing up in Auckland, it was amazing because there were so many opportunities and I was always in the studio, and I kind of guess that was a way of me kind of keeping out of trouble because I didn't really have time to, you know, go out and party and stuff when I was younger because I was always dancing. And it wasn't until I actually got older, and then in 2015 I was actually studying at Auckland University and I was selected to represent New Zealand at the Indigenous Dance Residency in Canada. And after I actually finished the residency, my mindset had kind of changed and I was like, actually, you know what? I want to create my own work. I want to be an individual artist who was making and creating work constantly that actually highlighted topics that I really feel strongly about. So that's where the journey really began. And then after that, I kind of started to develop more in terms of I started writing more and started doing poetry. And then when I went to London and came back, I came up with this idea of starting Travelling Feather. And at the beginning, it was just like, I want to go on Facebook and create some videos and I want all my brown people to be like, yes, queen. And after creating my first couple of videos and people were starting to respond to them and I realised people actually liked this and it was actually something that was needed, I continued to do that a bit more. And then when I was in New Zealand, I was actually working as a youth worker. And I had been helping all these young people and they would tell me, oh, I want to be this and I want to do this. And I'd hear all these amazing stories and I'd be telling them, girl, you can do this, or boy, you can do this. Keep fighting for what you want to do and break those stereotypes or break the mold that society puts on you to go and follow the exact same pathway as everybody else. And one day I had this young person say to me, you know what, you always encourage me to do what I want to do, but what are you doing for yourself? And I was like, oh my God, you actually are right. I might be dancing here and there and teaching classes, but I'm not doing something that fulfills me and fulfills my art to the extent that I really want to. So then I came up with this idea. I was going to actually move to Canada because I had kind of just gotten back from Canada. And then for some reason that ended up becoming London. And I knew nothing about London. All I knew was about the Queen and all the like Notting Hill Carnival and all the different things that happen over in the UK. But I didn't have a hell of a lot of knowledge about the art scene over there or just about London in general. So I was going over there with my eyes pretty much closed. I've always been someone who fights for Indigenous rights or fights for my rights as a human being or people of colour, but it became more prevalent in my work. I think the more that I grew up and the people that I surrounded myself with, I became more unapologetic about my work, and that's pretty much how I got to the places that I have got into with my work, is by just being unapologetic and really keeping it raw and keeping it real, because there's no point really putting, like, fabricating things or making things any less because you're scared to offend anyone. So sometimes you just, for me anyways, I had to get over myself and just realise that this is your artwork, so just be proud of it and don't hold back for anybody.
I want to come back to unapologeticness and I want to come back to London, but I want to pick up on what you said in terms of when you kind of reached that point where you decided, actually, I want my work to be about these ideas or issues that I feel really strongly about. What are those issues?
I feel like there's quite a lot of different issues. Like, when I auditioned for this show that I was actually a part of, which was Hive City Legacy, they asked me, what pisses you off? What makes you tick? What makes what makes you angry? And I had all these different ideas, but I hadn't really peeled them right back and couldn't really put them into this, like, one answer. But there are a lot of different things that, you know, drive my work, I guess. And a lot of that have been from my personal experiences or experiences of my friends or family. And just kind of, like, actually showing that this does exist. Like, a lot of the issues that I cover do end up coming back to race and racism, and kind of combating that and actually showing, hang on, just because we live in New Zealand doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It may be subtle, but it still does happen. And for me, it was really important to highlight all the different things and the feelings of how people of colour feel, not just Māori or Pacific, but also our black communities as well, and really just highlighting issues that not many people want to talk about or not many people know a lot about. So yeah, definitely those issues. And then there's just also issues about, like, gender and sex and things like that, and how in the Pacific lens we've had all these different genders and things like that exist for so many years, yet when it comes to Eurocentric views, it doesn't really fit into the idealistic perception of what it means to be a human, I guess. So it was kind of combating that and really peeling that open, having a look into that. And then I also started to go on this journey of really wanting to take it right back to the times before colonisation and really trying to explore the ways and the things that our ancestors used to do back in the days. And I've actually managed to learn quite a lot about all the different traditions that we do, not just on my Māori side, but also on the Pacific side, and also on my black side as well. So just really going back to the roots, the foundation, and really being able to pay homage to our ancestors. That's probably my main thing, is being able to, over all the work that we're doing, it's all about paying homage to our ancestors and really shedding light and celebrating our people and celebrating our melanin and our culture and our magic.
When you were growing up, or when you were sort of developing these ideas or developing your own work and those sorts of things, was there that kind of person that you're just describing, or that sort of work that you're just describing, modelling that already? Was there those people that represented what you've just described for you? Or do you think that this is a sort of time where there are a number of people in, I guess, our generation that are kind of taking what the previous generations have done in this area in terms of decolonizing, essentially, but taking it into this other, they've always done it, but taking it in another step, right? And sort of pushing that out in a different way, and with, especially with visual arts and what you're sort of talking about.
So for me growing up, I was kind of I wasn't really exposed to activism art. Yeah, so as a child, you'd go to Māori schooling and you'd get told to do this prayer to Jesus Christ, our Saviour, kind of thing. And it was kind of like, that was just how it went. You'd do all these colonial things that were kind of just not forced into, but ended up intertwining with a Māori culture. And for a while, I'd always question things. I've been the same since I was a kid. I've always been quite extra and very outspoken. So I'd question adults about, why do we do this? This doesn't make sense. Blah, 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 de, blah. And a lot of people, I used to have a lot of negative responses from people, especially people that don't really see eye to eye when it comes to kaupapa like that, or they've kind of been conditioned to think in a way that it was colonization was a good thing for us, kind of thing. So there wasn't really a lot of that when I was growing up, and I guess it was just kind of just me as a person, and my, the way that I was brought up by my parents was to just pretty much always be who you are, and pretty much who cares what other people think. That was something that I was told over and over as a kid by my parents, was to not worry about anyone else, worry about yourself, and as long as you stay humble, everything will be fine.
And I guess, would you agree that there are more and more of these people that are fighting for that, and fighting for that kind of representation, or fighting for that platform even?
Definitely. I think there has been a huge resurgence of Pacific artists, not that they weren't existing before, but this next generation are out here doing things around the world and really showing the world who we are, and really fighting for equality and fighting for all the things that our ancestors have been fighting for years. And obviously our ancestors have done a lot for us. There's a lot of progression that's happened since before I was born, you know. But we're now that next generation that have to step up and be a part of that and really push for that to get to where it needs to be. We've got a long way to go, but we've definitely made progress, but we still have a long way to go.
Like a sort of generation born into perhaps the steps that our parents took, and now you have to then take the next steps to push it further. Going back to London, part two, you've found your people, settled in, you're feeling good, and you've managed to form some sort of relationship with the Royal Academy of Arts in a year where they are celebrating Captain Cook. For somebody from Aotearoa, raised in Aotearoa and with a pretty specific relationship to Cook and to other settlers and colonisers, what?
So it's actually quite crazy that you asked that question, mainly because it was actually this year. So this year was like the big anniversary for Captain Cook, the coloniser, you know, and that wasn't the first project that I had actually been approached about doing something for. And it was actually at the beginning of the year. I went to Germany on a wānanga when we went to one of the marais and did some ngāho and really celebrated the space. And I met someone, her name's Jo Walsh, and she pretty much introduced me to the art scene over in London. And I was a part of this exhibition called Tūhuratanga, which was commissioned by the British Library, and I was their videographer for that. And this particular exhibition was exploring not only the way that we as Pacific people that live in the UK feel about Captain Cook, but just really about celebrating us as who we are now, not the image that society knows about us or the image that these historical Western historical documents have said about us. So that was pretty much my introduction to this whole Captain Cook subject. And then after that, we did some more work at the National Maritime Museum, and that was another Captain Cook one. And then I had a friend, well, I have a friend in London, her name's Ahi Lapalapa Rands, and she also recently did a Captain Cook exhibition in Whitby, where Captain Cook is actually from. And if you are in the UK, or if you ever go to the UK, I don't know if the exhibition's still on, but you'll hear me talking about what I think about Captain Cook and my views as an Indigenous person about Captain Cook. So it had been something that I had been talking about for most of the year, and I ended up doing this show called Hive City Legacy, which was about celebrating black women and femmes of colour, and just telling our stories and being unapologetic in that. And then after that show, it wasn't actually, what was it, about a week, not a week, but in my final month of being in London, someone that collaborated with our Hive City Legacy show from the Cocoa Butter Club knew someone from Art McCaver. And Art McCaver were collaborating with the Royal Academy of Arts to find a Pacific artist to draw. And that was the whole idea. So originally I was going to go into the space and I was going to perform and we were going to get people to draw me. And I kind of thought in my head, I was like, I don't know if this is what I want to do. And I also don't know how I feel about non-people of colour drawing me and their perception of what they think I look like and what they perceive of Pacific and savage and things like that. So I came up with this idea because I couldn't stay in London any longer to do the Exotic Savage exhibition, and that's kind of how that was born. I don't know if I've gone off topic.
But no, that's perfect, because now we're leading into, you managed to kind of say, no, that project is not probably the best way of doing this, problematic. I'm going to go home and I'm going to do this myself. The name of the film is Exotic Savage, The Decolonization. What is the film? How did you make it? What is it trying to say?
So Exotic Savage came out of the idea of the two words exotic and savage. Now, for me, the word exotic is a word that is always used to describe people of colour, no matter where you go in the world. And it was something living in Europe that I would hear constantly. People would be like, oh my God, you're so exotic. You look like Moana. And it got to a point that it kind of pissed me off. And what a lot of people don't understand is that exotic is a way of kind of othering people. And that word actually just means strange or foreign. And for me, it was like, I am not strange, I am not foreign, I'm not an alien, stop calling me exotic. And it came down to this idea of people just constantly exoticizing me because of the color of my skin, because of my ancestry, because of what I looked like. And then there was that whole idea of the word savage being a word that was really used in Western historical documents by the missionaries or by Captain Cook or whoever would come to New Zealand or the Pacific and write about us. And it wasn't just Indigenous people from the Pacific, but it was also Indigenous people across the world were called savages, or even just people in colour of general. Savage was a constant word, and that was a word that was used to compare us almost to animals. And for me, it was about reclaiming that and being like, I am not an exotic savage. So that's how I came up with the name for Exotic Savage. And then it was also that whole idea of decolonizing the mind through art, and that's why I called it Exotic Savage, The Decolonization. So this particular film, there were three aspects to the film. So the first aspect was coconut oil and the relationship between Pacific people and the scent of the Pacific, which is the smell of the coconut. And I explore that whole idea of how it related to my childhood and how it reminded me of the thousands of women I'd see at church and just smell this heavenly scent of coconut. And then halfway through, I start to talk about the derogatory term of coconut and how it is a word that was used to explain us in a way that wasn't very nice. And then the second aspect I looked at was hair and the relationship between women and hair, and how in Samoa we are told to tie our hair up, to not look in the mirrors at nighttime, to cover your mirrors, and if you don't, you're going to get taken away by the spirits. And for me, that was a way that we were told to not do these things in order for us to conform and to be not less, but to kind of just be more conservative. And I thought in my head, I was like, this is so stuffed up. Like, we should be able to be out there and proud about our sexuality, no matter what we're doing and no matter if we are women or not, you know? So that was the second aspect. And then the final aspect was about our feet and the connection that we have to the ground, so that no matter where you are in the world, you always know that you are home and that your ancestors are following you no matter where you go. And that was very important for me to show in London, because I have a lot of Pacific and Māori friends, or Māori is Pacific, but a lot of people from the Pacific and friends from the Pacific that were going to this exhibition, and they don't get to come home all the time, you know. So for them to be able to feel like they're at home, and then to remind themselves again that no matter where you are, home is always inside you, no matter the time or place or the season. So that was the three aspects that I looked at. And then I wanted to use people from all walks of life. I didn't want to just show people who were artists. I didn't want to just have artists that were women, or only have women, or only have men. I wanted to show everyone. So there was a wide range of people that I filmed. So I wanted to get your auntie who lives in her van with her cats, and I wanted to show your sister that's getting her degree, or your brother who is a tattooist, or your friends that are DJs. I wanted to show everyone and show them authentically and how they are, because I really wanted to break down the stereotypes of this word exotic savage. So that was the whole idea behind it. And it was so much fun to work with all these different people, like to hear their stories, because not only would I film them, but they would also be sitting there sharing what they've been up to, and then what they think about the project, and then what they think about the words exotic and savage. So there were a lot of different elements and contributions to the final product in the end, in terms of my poetry and then the way that it all worked out.
So you had those discussions, and that sort of helped inform you writing the poetry?
Definitely, because I didn't want it to just be from my point of view. I wanted to tell them what I've written or what I've been writing and how it's going to come through, and then they would kind of add on to it, and I'd be like, oh cool, so this, I want this to represent all of us, not just me. So, yeah, that's why I kind of... I wanted people to be themselves because I wanted to show people that are happy, people that are angry, people that are sad. I wanted to show all the different elements and show that pretty much Pacific people are not all the same. We are all completely different. Don't put us all into one box.
Touching on that sort of difference, but also going back to what you talked about in terms of unapologeticness, and that comes through, you get these people to talk about these things, but you mm-hmm. also get to them to state who they are and who they are not. That's what you wanted to showcase to London?
Pretty much. So what I also wanted to show to London was that we are so multiracial, we are diverse. And when I'd go over to overseas, a lot of people don't really understand the concept of being multiracial. They can only understand the concept of being mixed race. And when they think mixed race, all they think is African or Caribbean and then something from Europe, whether that be Spanish or whether that be British or Welsh. So for me, it was really important to shed light on the different communities that we have within the Pacific community and to show that, yes, we do have Afro-Polynesians that exist. I think that was one of my important factors to show, was because growing up in New Zealand, I was never ever classified as being part black. It was something that was kind of just pushed to the side. And when I try and say, be like, oh yes, I'm Cape Verdean and I'm Polynesian, I'm part black and I'm part Polynesian, people would look at me and then be like, no, you're not. You're just an islander. And for me, it really hurt me growing up, because then I started to kind of deny. I just stopped talking about it and didn't want to engage in conversations to do with it, because a lot of people would just look at me and be like, no, you're just a Polynesian. So for me, it was important to shed light on the fact that, yes, we have Māori Jamaicans, we have Samoan Cape Verdeans, we have Māori Ghanaians, we do exist, and our stories deserve to be told as well. So that was definitely important.
I think, well, because something that's quite powerful in the film, especially at the end, in terms of people saying, I'm not an exotic savage, because you talked about the audience of your Pacific friends seeing this, but it will also be an audience of Pākehā people who, white Europeans that aren't actually Pākehā, because Pākehā is specific to Aotearoa, but people in Britain who often don't have an understanding of colonisation as we understand it here. Mm-hmm. And that could be quite confronting. Was that your purpose?
Definitely. That was definitely my purpose. So for me, going into this, I had a few people be like, oh, do you think this is appropriate? Do you think people are going to be offended? And I just had to pull myself back and be like, firstly, this is my art. Don't tell me what to do. Secondly, that's the point. I didn't really care if you liked it, if you were offended by it, or even if you did really love it. All I wanted was for people to react. If I got a reaction from you, then I'm happy, because it made you think. And there was definitely people that were offended. I had the girl who was facilitating the exhibition in London said this lady came up to her and was like, I was very, very offended by this video. And then I just said to her, I was like, good, I really liked the fact that she was offended. Now tell me why. Why are you offended by this? For me, at the end of the day, this project wasn't made for white Europeans. I know that they were going to see it and that there'd be a large audience of them, but this was actually made for our people. I didn't make this for anyone else except for people of the Pacific. And then, of course, there were people that were like, I love this, I learned something from this. But I guess if you're ignorant and you don't want to learn, well, of course, you're going to be offended by this. But yeah, there were a lot of different points that I cover through it that would have definitely had some eyebrows raised. But for the most part, I'm sure a lot of people did end up enjoying the video, and a lot of the New Zealanders, the Pākehā New Zealanders that were there, they understood it because they get it, because they know all about colonisation here. Well, not everybody, but they have more of an understanding because they're from here. If you go to places like the UK, I've asked so many people if they know who Captain Cook is, and they think I'm talking about Captain Hook. And I'm like, no, not the one on Peter Pan, just the one that came over to New Zealand and stuffed everything up for all the Indigenous people.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Shakaya is looking to host an exhibition here in Aotearoa with the film before returning to London, and is looking to hear how the New Zealand Pacific community responds to the film. Normally we would have some ads now, but there are no ads, which is great. So up next we've got Marama Davidson, co-leader of the Green Party, was at the annual Waihopai spy-based demonstration this weekend protesting against international spying. Davidson says that sort of spying puts the human rights and privacy of global citizens at risk. Hamish Webber spoke with her to find out more and started by asking why she is protesting.
The culture of spying is It's a bit of an overreach, actually. And so the Greens have been very clear for the whole, for the decades that that protest has been taking place, that we shouldn't really be allowing governments to use their powers to reach into our digital mailboxes. We wouldn't like it for our paper mailboxes. So there's no real surprise that we shouldn't be allowing governments to do it to our email and our social media messaging and so on. So we've been very clear that what are spying powers being used for is something that needs to be asked as well. And we've seen our own government at the end of last year. I was calling out our own government in the past using its powers and teaming up with big industry and big oil to spy on people who are displaying dissent, not people who are a threat to the country's security, people who are actually trying to protect our environment. And so I think it's quite natural for the Greens to be very wary of keeping these spying powers in check.
I read in the press release that talked about the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security getting made into like an officer of parliament. So like, would that change any of the operations?
We just need to make sure that both the Inspector General, the person who needs to keep our spying powers in check, is fully independent and has as much reach as he or she needs to have. We need to make sure that the committee, that the parliament committee responsible for oversight of our spying powers, is also accessible and all the information is available to elected representatives. This is all about making sure that we've got all the tools we need, including the Inspector General, including the Parliamentary Committee, that we've got all the tools we need to keep a real monitor on how these spying powers are being used, what purpose they're being used for, and, you know, and calling into question our own sovereign independence. Why are we buddying up with the Five Eyes, the countries, the UK, Australia, the US and Canada, to search people's private communications? And so the erosion of privacy and those liberal freedoms is not to be scoffed at.
What are you hoping will come from this sort of protest?
So I thanked, on the day I travelled to Blenheim and travelled out to the Whitehall Place Spy Base for my first time ever. And I really was there to also thank those people, those groups, who were calling governments around the world to account for overextending spying powers.
Yeah.
You know, it's actually the beginning of a fascist state, is extending spying powers merely to people who disagree with government direction or disagree with policy. And I was there to thank people for their ongoing work. There's a discussion that we need to be having in the halls of Parliament if we are serious and genuine in our concern for our nation's security and safety. There are other ways of being able to do that without having unnecessary spying powers and without eroding our privacy, such as using our police to keep to the criminality of activity, which has been done in the past. Rainbow Warrior was called up through police. And so being able to use the agencies we already have to actually have real solutions to protecting our nation's security.
The Wire.
That was Madame Davidson speaking to Hamish Webber. We've got some text in from the piece before that. Wow, I love it. I have Māori, Irish, Scottish, and then found more through DNA tests. I'm looking in further. When anyone asks where I am from, I say Earth, from Grizzy. And somebody else saying, wow, harsh, not sure. Captain Cook fucked things up for Indigenous people. All he did was make some maps. Not sure he single-handedly introduced colonialism. I probably wouldn't reduce what Captain Cook did to just making some maps, but yes, you are right, there was a entire process of introducing colonialism, one part of which Captain Cook was definitely involved in. That's The Wire.
That was The Wire.
Quick Kua tae ki te mutunga, koera te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Yes, that brings us to the end of our show for another week. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. Big thanks to all of those who spoke with us for the show today. Marcus Jones, Marama Davidson and Shakaya Perez. Nei rā, hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thank you to all of you who tuned in. Ka hoki mai mātou a tērā wiki, that's us for Wednesday Wire. We'll be back next week. And Bridge is up next with the 1 to 4. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.